I'm Neil.
I'm Louise.
And I'm Ronnie.
I'm Daisy's dad.
I'm Daisy's mum.
And I'm Daisy's grandpa.
In 2018, Daisy was diagnosed with regressive autism.
She gradually lost all of her speech and began to show typical autistic traits.
She'd spin in circles, avoid eye contact, and make loud monotone noises.
This was a huge shock, as up until this point, Daisy had been speaking in 7 or 8 word sentences.
And had memorised pretty much 20 to 30 books.
Since then, we've all been on a journey of discovery.
In this podcast, we'll talk about that journey.
And explore the impact autism has had on all of us.
The lows.
And the highs. This is the story of Daisy.
And me.
Episode 6, Surviving and Thriving.
We've learned a lot of ways to survive while Daisy's sort of undergoing changes or having meltdowns.
Yeah. And, Sauvignon Blanc.
Sauvignon Blanc, yeah.
In buckets.
Beer.
Oh, this is a really good start, yeah. Then. Yeah.
You know, this isn't a health podcast.
No, no.
but it's weird because you actually just develop these ways of coping with what's happening, don't you?
Yeah, I think you sort of have to, don't you? Because it is the only way to survive is just to find ways of dealing with stuff. I think what I've noticed is that we're both quite good when something's happening, like she's having a meltdown, or sometimes you can pick up when the other person is either getting stressed or has reached their level. Yeah. It's the same overnight as well. And there's always the other one there that mm-hmm. seems to just be able to step in and yeah. pick up that and be calm. So I think we sort of tend to bounce off each other, don't we? I think we use humour quite a lot as well. Mm. I think that's been quite important. Yeah. But
it is actually quite, when the moments, I think it's probably our senses of humour, when the moments sometimes that it's darkest,
yeah.
it's also the funniest.
Yeah.
Well, you know what it's like when yeah. she's really having a meltdown
yeah.
and the top lip comes out like a cartoon character.
She did it the other day, didn't she?
Honestly. You can't help but...
Well, we just looked at each other and it's awful. When she properly escalates, you don't laugh because it's bad, but it's when that lip comes out and I just looked at you and I just couldn't stop laughing. You have to hide it because yeah. you don't want to distress her.
Yeah.
But I've never seen a face like it. It's sort of her nose all goes up as well, doesn't it? It's
I just remember because it's obviously not something that is exclusive to parents of autistic children trying to find ways of surviving, particularly in the first few years, you're sleep deprived and
yeah
and all that sort of stuff. And I remember that first do you remember that first night back home
from the hospital?
Yeah, yeah. And Daisy was having a screamer, and you know, we didn't know anything by this point, but
this is just us
just going
warm.
Mad.
Oh right, yeah.
And we looked at each other and went, what
have we done? Can we give her back?
Yeah. And I think from there on, we've basically had sort of little sleep, broken sleep, the odd half-decent night.
Yeah.
But you develop a way of, I mean, we're like every parent, we're tired all the time.
Yeah. It's the state you get into. Because when we were bringing you two up, you and Stuart up, we just used to tag team it. We talked about this before.
Yeah.
You tag team it and you just go into that groove. Mm. And so you're always in a state of ready to nap.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? You're always ready to have that kept. Mm. And another thing as well is when she's not sleeping, you've also got the thing of, is she going to sleep for how long?
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like if I take her out in the car and she invariably drops off,
yeah.
you know, how long do we let her sleep because we want to sleep at night?
Yeah.
And so you do the kind of coping with that as well. So you think, okay, for instance, just take her out in the car. She likes a drive. Mm. I'll let her drive now.
She's not so good with manual, though.
I'll get her an automatic. But you do have a survival with all your kids, regardless yeah. whether they've got autism or not. I remember, I think it was you, I think it was Stuart. And he was just, it was 2 hours sleep and then waking up and they would be unhappy.
Yeah.
So, and I think for parents, that's the worst thing
yeah.
is you just don't want them to be unhappy. And when Daisy has a meltdown,
yeah.
you're realising she's unhappy, but other things are there as well.
I
yeah.
think when we, when, the meltdowns issues is quite an interesting one, because I remember the first meltdowns in public.
A proper autism meltdown.
They were horrible. I remember you telling me about the Nando's incident.
Yeah, yeah.
And which you should probably explain.
Well, I just took her down to the leisure park in Ely. Mm. I was going to take her in for. I said, right, let's go and get some cake.
Yeah.
At Costa's, a cup of coffee, and she likes a wee espresso. No, she doesn't.
Yeah.
No, but she didn't want to go. She wanted to go up to the cinema.
Yeah.
Which she's never been to, you know. So we went up there, went inside the cinema, it was open, we wandered around. I said, okay, come out, first meltdown.
Yeah.
Then we come out, I managed to get her out, and then she wanted to get to Nando's, which wasn't open.
She didn't even like chicken.
No. Meltdown again, and then she wanted to go to the Ilele pub. I said, no, we can't, and she just melted. Then you get cars going past you.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the thing of you feel completely inadequate. You know, I'm grandpa. I'm supposed to be the good guy. Mm. And even I can't get her to calm down. And I'd never seen her doing this. She'd never really had a meltdown with me. And it was scary. It was puzzling, perplexing, and frustrating, because, you know, I couldn't.
You don't know what to do.
I couldn't answer the question.
No.
What would you do now? If it happened in public,
I just lock her in the cupboard now. No,
but if she had a really, because my attitude from the first meltdown in public to now, is completely different.
Yeah,
because what I've realised is if people are looking at you and judging you, nothing you can do about that.
No,
generally speaking, though, a lot of people go, oh. Like, you know, and they just sort of give you the nod to know that you're having a bad time, or I've had a bad time. What would you do if she...
I just do the same regime that you more or less do, because you can't pick her up.
No.
She won't let you pick
her. It makes it impossible.
So I do the deflection thing, and hands up, I'll be honest, and your pepper comes out of my pocket.
That's what we do.
And and you're so right about getting used to it. Mm. And getting used to people looking at you. I don't get embarrassed now at all. Mm. I did at first because I thought, well, come on. Because, you know, I was becoming a person going, well, why can't you keep a control of your kids? But now I know one of my coping things is Peppa.
Yeah.
And she looks at and she calms down. It takes her to that place and calms down. And actually now she's getting to the stage where she's had enough Peppa. She'll
leave it. She's done that a couple of times today. She's sort of just had her fill and that's it. But it's the meltdowns, it's interesting because they are so different to ordinary children's tantrums. And I think until you've sort of seen one and experienced one with her, it's hard to know what people mean by.
I hadn't seen one. You told me about it. I hadn't seen that was my very first one. Mm. Actually, I haven't had that many. We get many times of meltdowns. Mm.
She just, it's like she just completely loses all control of her emotions and it escalates, doesn't it? And she sort of works herself up into this frenzy and she doesn't know what to do with herself. So we've had a bit of a bad morning with meltdowns. So she's sort of she throws herself on the floor, but it doesn't sort of matter what's around. So she knocks into things. But again, it was sort of like almost like commando roles this morning.
You know what? At the last World Cup when Neymar kept getting fouled.
Yeah.
And then he'd roll around for like ages and ages. That's what she does.
Yeah. So, and it was funny at first, but then you see she's getting angrier and her feet are stomping and she was kicking you, wasn't she, at one point? So I think we just sort of let her ride it out now. It's that whole, you know, there is nothing you can do except just be there to make sure she's safe. Yeah. And that's the only thing you can do. And then what we do is we sometimes use pepper if that is the way of calming down. It doesn't always work.
Yeah.
But
oh, they all fell out. All fell out.
All I've read.
You're going to put them back in?
Generally speaking,
frog, piggy, airplane. It's a clever girl.
But you see, doing this podcast has been a massive help because I now have, and I don't know who it was, maybe all our guests have said this, but this, what's happening in her brain is this pile on.
Yeah.
She's getting all these emotions, and we can deal with it. We can actually sort them out.
Yeah.
She can't. So when the meltdown happens, it's not bad behaviour.
Yeah.
It's a sensory meltdown she's having.
Well, you remember Sienna from last week? Mm. She said that, you know, it feels like everything is caving in. Yeah. She's talking about the cardigan being scratchy and it being like psychological torture. Mm. I read something on online this morning, and I know you do this as well, and I think you do this as well, on the topic of surviving. As a parent, when you walk into a room, you scan everything.
Risk assess. We talked about that in one of the previous episodes.
Everything, don't you? Yeah. You're walking and going, right, that's a sharp corner. She could eat that.
There's an
she
escape route there. There's a body of water there.
I think a lot of parents will do that anyway.
Yeah.
Especially with babies, with toddlers. Yeah. But when, it's the things like eating and, you know, and picking things up. And
I think what's good about Daisy now, though, is she's kind of learning her own ways to survive,
regulate.
Isn't she?
Yeah.
She's got to a point where, you know, for instance, when she's around
cousins,
other people or cousins or whatever, she gets to a point where she takes herself away if it's getting too much.
I've noticed with her is that she clearly defines when she's done, if she's finished with something. Like when we have the disco, you know, up on the same song again and again and again, and then she'll say, right, that's it. Done with it. And she'll move on to the next thing. So it's good in that respect as well. But also the other thing is when you go into a room full of strangers, we talked about this before, Lou, about telling people she's autistic. I don't do that now.
No.
I don't do it. I just think, no, this is Daisy. And, and in fact, I took her into the co-op the other day. I had to get some bananas. And she was brilliant.
Yeah.
She was very funny. She was dragging me along, doing that kind of running as if she's going to fall over. She'd never been in the co-op before, I don't think. And it was great because that was the first time that I'd taken her into does this sound really silly? It's the first time since lockdown I've taken her into a supermarket.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I didn't put her
in the trolley.
She walked beside me, held my hand, was taking, looking in at things. It was great.
Funny that, because I tell you what that highlights is sometimes you have to go into these situations blind.
Yeah.
Because if you'd said to me, I'm going to take her to the co-op, I might have said to you, stick her in a trolley, give her Peppa Pig. Because generally, like, I went to Sainsbury's yesterday and the Wi-Fi wasn't working and it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And she just screamed the whole
time. When you've got
around.
To do a big shop, though, it's the only way to get around.
It does show you that sometimes you just have to go, right, now we're going to change this.
Yeah.
And we're just going to go in, because I'm quite surprised by that.
Yeah.
Right.
I wouldn't have thought.
You're eating your custard with your hands, are you?
It's custard.
Eating custard with your hands or with your spoon?
Smoon.
With your smoon. Is it nice? Is it fruit and custard? Nice?
What's that?
The custard.
It's custard.
Fruit and custard.
There's a pepper.
Yeah, pepper's at the bottom of the bowl.
I think we need to start, when you've only got a couple of bits to get, that's what we need to start doing, because we do have a tendency to put her in the trolley, because I think the times I haven't have just been, I've had to abandon a trolley of shopping.
I think
of
a bonus as well, it was maybe the pandemic that made me think about it, you know,
putting
the trolley and everything, but I was only going in for a couple of things.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing as well is I took her out, she was one of the days, she was not having a great day, so I took her out. And actually, I went to check my tyres. This is such a boring anecdote. Sorry, everybody. But I just nipped into the park, unplanned.
Yeah.
Right? Because you know what we're talking about? I try when I'm looking after her, I think, right, she can have a bit of that. Then we'll maybe disco. Then we'll maybe out in the garden. Actually, it just flowed.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe that I need to do a bit more of that. Though some days that works.
Yeah, and some days it doesn't. It just depends. It's so hit and miss, isn't it? But it's funny, I was just thinking about what you were saying about the sort of regulating that she does. And it was really interesting because we took her to, I think we've mentioned that the inflator bounce, it's this, the bouncy castle land she likes. So we took her back there for a second time and it was quite a bit busier, wasn't it, this time? So there were quite a few children on one of the particular things that she likes. And you could see she desperately wanted to be on there, but it was too much. There were too many other children and she just wasn't coping, was she? But she didn't want to get off. So she came over to the edge and she just took my hand. She wanted me to get on. So I got on. I was a bit wary because there were so many people. But I just sort of perched in the corner, didn't I? Mm. And she was fine. And she just kept coming back to me every so often and looking around and checking I was there. And then she was jumping in and around all of these other children.
Yeah.
So she sort of, it was almost that she knew she wanted to stay on there, but just by having me nearby was enough to regulate her and keep her. It was interesting, wasn't it?
Well, I talked about survival is when we were at the park the other day, you know, the big slide, which she dived on and there was a queue of kids around.
Yeah.
And we were worried about bullying and things like this. She went straight to the front of the queue.
Yeah.
She went straight to, because she's not got that spatial awareness. You know,
I need to be on the slide.
Yeah.
You're in the way.
Yeah. I'm going to take her to the sales.
You put these kids in the way.
I'm going to take her to the sales. He's all right. We want the telly. Yeah. Get the telly. And she'll just go for it. Yeah. But it's funny. The other kids kind of accommodated her. There was an assertiveness.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that because I was about to say that kids generally, I don't want to, what it's going to be like in school, but when they're around adults, kids are pretty accepting. Mm-hmm. Of it.
Yeah.
They might ask questions. I mean, you...
I met up with a couple of sort of NCT friends. So we've sort of known each other since they were all babies. And actually, it's sort of really interesting seeing them all growing up. But one of my friend's little boys just said, "Does Daisy not talk?" And he asked the question.
Right.
So I was able to explain to him that she didn't. And I just said she has a condition, which means she can't talk, but she does understand and she wants to play with you. It's just that she doesn't understand how. And he just sort of said, "Oh," and then he just walked off.
Yes.
Yes. But it just actually, it was lovely because he was inquisitive about it. So it's quite funny when you see other friends' children, because my friend Anna's little boy is really hilarious because they have a love-hate relationship. And he really loves Daisy and they sort of play in their own way together. But because she doesn't conform and do the things that he wants her to, he's a bit older, he sort of bosses her around. So if she's doing something he thinks she shouldn't be, he'll go over and he'll say, oh, Daisy's doing this, she shouldn't be this. And he tries to stop her, but she completely ignores him. So he gets even more frustrated. And it's just really hilarious watching them. It's just such a funny...
I hope that aspect of her character is what helps her get on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling it might be, because that... Because obviously she is intelligent. Obviously she knows receptive language. She understands questions and stuff. But I think it will dawn on her at some point.
Yeah.
Why am I not talking?
Yeah.
And the key to getting around that, I don't know. But you would hope that sort of gung-ho, push past kids on the slide attitude would help overcome that hurdle.
See, I don't know, because when you're talking there about she knows she can't speak, will she have normalised the fact that she can't speak, so she doesn't actually come to a point going, I don't talk?
I don't know, because it depends on her type of autism, doesn't it? Because again, the speech issues are different for every person. So again, I think we've mentioned before, some children think they're talking but the words aren't coming out, or she might not even consider that talking is something she
needs
can
to
do or needs to do. Yeah. So it's, I think time will tell.
Yeah, I have a feeling that there will be a realisation. I don't know why I have that feeling. I just do. And I think that
maybe
help. A, B, C, D.
You sing with me.
Yay! Woo!
Yay!
Well done.
Is that well done?
I said at the start, when she was through the heart operation, she's a fighter. She's a and she's got an attitude to her. As we know, she's got
that
attitude.
From her granddad.
Yeah, and she gets she knows what she wants, and she knows now how to go about it. because we've discovered she knows how to open all the drawers now.
Yeah.
Weirdly. But I think in the playground situation, and we'll get you school starting this week.
Yeah.
On Friday.
Yeah.
I was relieved because I didn't know she was going to be part of a special group.
Okay.
I've been having late nights thinking, how's she going to cope with a classroom of kids who are ordinary, and she's extraordinary. Mm. How's she going to cope with that? Of course, she's not going to have to cope with that.
No. So she's going to be with other children, not necessarily the same, but with additional needs. So, and it'll be within a mainstream school, but it's a special unit. So we're quite lucky to have that place for her, because it's not.
The good thing is as well, in terms of, we were talking about familiarity being a key to her surviving, is that she's got Miss Weimer,
who's her TA,
she knows and all that. But it'll be an interesting couple of years, because actually how she gets on through this next few years will make a lot of the decisions for
about where she goes to school, whether it's mainstream or,
I suppose when this episode we've got Anne Hegarty on, and Anne obviously is someone who's doing really well in her career, and has dealt with
very assertive. And also a wee insight into when you hear her talking, she's very, very she doesn't like needy people.
No.
And that kind of that aspect, I don't know whether it's an autistic, that thing of, right, here's what happens. Mm. This is going to happen. I don't need that, and I don't need this.
Yeah.
This is what, so don't bother me with other little bits.
Yeah.
This is what's going
to
happen.
But I think it's nice to have Anne on as a sort of almost, this is where you can get to.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But I think for us, the thriving bit is almost a more short-term thing, isn't it?
Definitely.
We just need to make sure she can, so things like the sleep, we've got melatonin now for her, which we're sort of going to work out, and just kind of getting through the next few years, and then the next few years.
And then like last week, I think we just go through term. Just go through, because we already know in the last 6 months we've seen a big difference.
Yeah.
There is a big difference. She's more in the world. She's more eye contact. So things are happening, which is exciting.
Mm. Yeah.
It's great to see her getting on and enjoying it. Right. So let's get to our guest, Anne Hegarty.
So Anne is one of the quizzes on The Chase, which is ITV's big tea time quiz show. She's known as the governess.
Yes.
And I think we found out that she's very much in control of everything.
And very funny too. Anne, Daisy was diagnosed at the age of 2. You were diagnosed at the age of 45. When you were growing up, did your parents suspect there was an issue?
They thought there was an issue. They didn't know what it was. What you have to remember is it wasn't until the 1990s that Lorna Wing started doing some research into Asperger's notes. And it dawned on her that he was actually describing something not unlike what Kanna had described, just sort of at a different point on a spectrum. And that was when she worked out that there was an autistic spectrum and you could actually be verbal and sort of, reasonably functional and still be on it. When I was a child, it was still believed that autism was caused by parental abuse. And obviously, everyone looked at my mum and dad and they said, well, the dad's obviously mental, but they're not actually an abusive couple. It obviously wasn't that. And I was talking. I talked sort of at the normal age, and I didn't stop. I haven't stopped since. stop me, somebody. People knew there was something wrong. I mean, I went to see my first child psychologist when I was 6. And then when I was 12, I got sent to the Tavistock, which then as now is a sort of very prestigious child psychology clinic. And in those days I was reading Bunty and things like that. And I thought, whoa, boarding school, that sounds so cool. And I said to the people at the Tavistock, maybe I should go to boarding school. And oddly enough, they actually thought that was a very good idea. I didn't go to the same school as I went to a school in the same county. For the first sort of year, I was pretty traumatized by the whole thing. But in many ways, it was a very good thing. One thing, it gave me a lot of structure. I knew at any one point in the day what I should be doing, even if what I should be doing was whatever I felt like, even if I knew that this was free time, I knew how long it was going to be free time for. So you knew when meal times were, you knew when prep was, you knew when bedtimes were, and it just kind of all made it very clear to you, and it was easy to follow those rules. And then also, it was a much more, it was a school that kind of, it didn't exactly push you academically, but it kind of, if you were not working hard, it kind of let everybody know about it. And I sort of realized, okay, you know, I hadn't realized before that I was competitive because my mother was tremendously anti-competitive. But I was like, right, you know I can do better than this, so let's knuckle down and do it. So from that point of view, it was very useful as well.
Did you find, because we know that in a weird way with Daisy, we feel slightly lucky in so much that she was diagnosed early, so we're sort of on all the right tracks with, you know, SEND and all that sort of stuff. Did you find when you were growing up the lack of understanding impacted you in any particular way? I'm just sort of talking about, we know we hear about lots of girls being underdiagnosed with
autism. Yeah, I mean, I do sometimes ask myself, would it have been better if people had known about the autistic spectrum, if I'd been diagnosed, you know, at the same age as Daisy? And part of me thinks, yes, that would have been brilliant. And then part of me thinks, but might people have expected less of me? Might people have not focused on the fact, you know, that I was obviously bright, that I was obviously good at language and languages, and you know, might people have been... When I think about it, speaking to people who remember my mother, they say that she was actually very protective of me, that she kind of tried to shelter me from a lot of things. And I'm not sure that was a terribly good thing. And if she'd actually been able to put a name to it, who knows, she might have, you know, insisted on sheltering me from practically everything. And that would not have been good.
When you were in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and of course everybody said that you outed yourself as autistic, but you'd been talking about
your... Rita asked me.
Yeah, exactly, so yeah, because it wasn't a definite decision, and everybody said it, and it was brilliant you did as well, and everybody who had an association with autism was really encouraged by it. But one of the things that was picked up in that declaration, if you like, Anne, was the fact that nobody could realise you were autistic. You had ways of masking your autistic, and so they couldn't quite believe it, the other contestants.
I think they could believe it when I started having hysterics when they dropped bugs all over me. I mean, you know, Emily Atack also had hysterics, and then she powered through and did it because that's what Emily does. Whereas, you know, I had hysterics and then said, I'm a Celebrity, get me out of here, and came back with 2 stars. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. Was I masking it? I mean, as I say, right from when I was a child, everyone knew something was weird, and I didn't know exactly what it was that was weird. And of course, one wants to be normal and fit in. But at the same time, I mean, what I often feel I would tell my younger self is, try not to mind that you like being on your own. You know, embrace that. Go for walks on your own. It's okay. That doesn't entirely answer your question, sorry.
Did you pick up techniques to pick up social cues and things when you were growing up?
Yeah. Not so much when I'm growing up, but certainly as an adult. I mean, I've read various books. I'm pretty sure everyone who was diagnosed late has got a shelf full of self-help books. That, you know, this will make me normal, or at least this will make me functional. I've used sort of various books. Like, oddly enough, Helen Gurley Brown's Having It All was very useful. It's just a sort of primer on how to be an early 1980s woman. But, you know, it comes up with all sorts of ideas that I hadn't thought of, like exactly how to be a good listener. I hadn't sort of worked out that, you know, you do this thing called reflective listening, and you reflect back to people what they said, and they think you were actually interested. And and you know, you can go a long way faking that sort of thing. I'm interested, but you can't tell.
It's interesting you say that, Anne, because I think everyone does that from time to time, where they aren't necessarily, particularly at work, maybe they're not necessarily interested in what other people are saying, but they can mask it.
Most of the time, what people do is just sort of, you know, point their face in that direction and open their eyes wide and say, nod and say, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what you actually need to do is to hear what the person's saying and rephrase it and saying back to them and say, so you're saying that blah, blah, blah. And then, wow, she was really listening. Well, I was, but only because I was doing my listening thing. I might actually have been really interested, but I'd probably do it even if I wasn't.
Do you think, Anne, going back to your school days, we've spoken to guests on this podcast who talk about the moment that they found the right friends. So friends who understood their differences and sort of helped them through them. Did you find a moment in school or adulthood where you found the right people to be around?
I think a major moment was when I got to journalism college in Cardiff in 1981. I graduated from Edinburgh, where I was thoroughly miserable. I'd spent a year on the dole trying to get trainee jobs as a journalist and failing, I think, because it was sort of quite obvious from my letters that I didn't really know what I was talking about. I mean, I think that now with hindsight. And then I managed by the skin of my teeth to get onto this course and get a bursary. And it was like from the first week that the course started, I thought, oh, I get these people and they get me. And they actually seem happy to have me around. They want me around. And I also sort of understood what the course was asking of me. And I did well on that. But I remember Christmas of the course, because obviously it started in September, October. And Christmas, there was a party. And I said, no, I wouldn't go if that was OK. Largely because I really couldn't believe anyone actually wanted me at the party. I thought, what am I going to do? I never see the point of parties. And I can't believe they really want me there. And the morning after, I remember everyone piling into the room and one of the tutors looking straight at me and saying, you were missed last night, you bugger. And I went, really? Oh, good heavens, you mean people actually wanted me? That hadn't occurred to me. I thought you were just being polite. So, I did sort of start tentatively actually going to parties and discovering things like garlic bread, which is the future, I'm told. well, it was in 1981. Actually getting along with people and making friends that I still have. Which is extraordinary.
When with maturity, you know, we get a lot of things and we get wise and everything. You've talked in the past about wee things like in the house, you get overwhelmed by tasks. As you've got older, do you cope more? Because I'm just thinking about a normal day's recording of the chase. You're doing that. You're under pressure, so you must feel overwhelmed sometimes.
But see, the chase isn't the kind of pressure that's a problem. I mean, what I have when it's a recording day, I wake up and I get coffee and I'm already feeling overwhelmed. And I sit down with the computer and I go have a shower and I get dressed and I probably don't have breakfast. And I get in the car and I get to the studio I get made up and I get changed and then I get taken down to the studio floor. And as they're miking me up on the studio floor, at this point, I start thinking, right, that's the difficult bit over. I mean, now I know what I'm doing. Now I'm in my comfort zone. This is when I know what I'm doing. Even more so when I've, had the bit of the chat with the contestant and then Bradley goes, the chase is on, and you hear that little bit of music. And there is a moment of me thinking, oh, no, this is where they find me out. This is where I'm going to get asked a question I have no idea about. But at the same time, mostly it's sort of, ah, good, now we can get underway. Now I can do what I know I can do. So that's the point at which I'm sort of like, well, I can do this. This is not the hard bit. The hard bit is sort of actually making myself get in the shower and get dressed.
See, that's really interesting because we've spoken to guests in previous episodes on the podcast who've talked about fueling the obsession in autistic children. And I suppose for you, your obsession would be quizzing. And I wondered how much it was an obsession, whether you describe it as an obsession, and how much you did fuel it.
I know what you mean. I tend to use the word perseveration. Which is when, you know, you happen to watch something on TV or you read a book and something just catches your imagination and you're like, right, for the next 6 weeks, I'm gone. I am down the rabbit hole. I need to know everything about this. And for the last 10 years or so, I've really tried very hard not to develop perseverations because I'm like, I can't afford them. I haven't got time to have them. So a lot of the things that I, you know, normally I would become utterly obsessed with, they've had to go on the back burner because I just think, okay, I daren't. I mean, there are all sorts of TV shows I have not dared to watch. I've not dared to get into them because I'm like, I will be gone. I can see exactly the effect this show will have on me and I'm really better not. Game of Thrones is one of them. I'm like, no, I'm going to put that off because I it's not safe for me.
to get into it and do the binge.
Yeah, because... Really, what I discovered, I mean, back when I was a freelance proofreader, literally I would get hold of something and I had to just motor through it for about 6 weeks. And I would sometimes stay up all night. I had the telephone line cut off because I was just on the computer all the time reading about things. And like I said, stay up all night. After about 10 days, it sort of calmed down a little bit. And then about 3 weeks later, it was like, right, okay, this has now just become an interest. And I can just deal with it as an interest and I can get back to real life. And it was rather a relief to be able to get back to real life because you feel like a rat in the jaws of a dog.
Mm. You were saying earlier on, Anne, that you know there's much more understanding of autism than when you were growing up.
Yeah.
We obviously the reason we're doing the podcast is to help us understand Daisy and maybe to help other parents who are going through the same thing. Do you think we're making big leaps ahead talking about autism, or is there so much more to be done?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously, everyone is sort of very interested. I mean, in my case, people want to talk to me all the time, but there's a lot that I sort of try to explain, and I'm not sure how far everyone's always listening. I'm distracted by the fact my shoulders are going in and out of the eagle cluster. Can you see that thing behind me?
Yes, yeah.
It's the pillars of creation. If I sit back, maybe it won't do it. Right. So, where was I? Distracted is where I was. Yeah, things like there are certain things I wish people would understand and I explain them and they say they understand and then they do the exact same thing again. Me saying, look, if I hear something through speech, I will respond in the normal sort of way, but I'm quite possibly not actually retaining it on a long-term basis. So could you put that in an email to me? And they say yes and then they don't. And if I'm on the phone, it's okay because I can have a notebook and I can take a shorthand note. One of the useful things about having gone to journalism college in the early 80s, I still do shorthand. I can do that. If it's a conversation over lunch or something, I only retain the vaguest outline of what was said. But there are some people who are like, you know, I've always got to do this over a phone call. I don't like emails. I'm like, fine, okay. But I really may not retain what you said. And when I suddenly need to understand this, I may feel absolutely blindsided because I only have the sketchiest idea of what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm. So it'd be nice, for example, if people would get that.
Yeah.
Anne, we've been in a weird situation in the last 6 months. Everyone's been in it together. In a weird way, you sort of had your own mini lockdown a couple of years ago in the jungle. Completely different, obviously. But how have you found the whole process of lockdown?
It's been absolutely brilliant. I have loved it. I mean, people say, but what about cessation of routine? And I'm sort of like, what routine? I mean, so much is different. Every day, if we're filming The Chase, I'm probably doing a different show, so I'm in at different times. I may not be filming The Chase. I may be doing something else. I may have a number of different things to do, and every day is different. Whereas here, I could make every day the same. And I could actually focus. What I've wanted for years is a big chunk of unstructured time that I could structure for myself rather than having to. It takes time for me to sort of crank my brain up. It's a bit like starting up a computer. You know, you don't want to start it up and shut it down too many times. because it takes ages to get going, and you know, and it's rough on the hard disk. And I find, you know, I need time between tasks, not just what other people think is adequate time, but I need thinking time. I need downtime to sit and imagine to myself what I'm going to do. I mean, there are times when, you know, I should be having a shower and I'm lying on the bed imagining, you know, okay, I'm going to wear that and that, which is in the other drawer, and then that, which is hanging up there, and that, which is there. And I'm going to go into the bathroom, and I'm going to hang up the dressing gown, and I'm going to, and I have to do it in steps and imagine all of it to myself, because I can't, if I try to do things at the same speed as everyone else, I start shaking. And my voice goes high, and everyone can tell that I'm very stressed. You were asking about the way that women do things, yes, rather than men. The problem with being an autistic girl is that other girls get tremendously sociable, and they want you to be very socially oriented as well. And I can remember in primary school some child saying, "Will you be friends with me?" And I said, no, don't think so, because I just thought, I don't actually sort of need any friends. Why would I need a friend? And then a couple of hours later, I came upon a bunch of girls sitting on the stairs, and I said, can I get past? And they said, no, because you're not my friend. I was like, oh, okay, so we all have to be in little tribes, do we? I mean, as an adult, you know, people, especially if you're working on your own, and I mean, I've been freelance in one way or another since the mid-80s. They're less pushy about needing you to be their friend. But I still do feel, you know, wow, are other people needy? And that bothers me. And how old is Daisy? Four?
Yeah.
She's four, yeah.
Yeah. If she's the sort of person that's actually sort of fine on her own, she's going to need to sort of learn to fake wanting to be friends.
Yeah.
Even if she doesn't, because she has to pretend to want to. I've spent most of my life doing things not because I wanted to, but because I wanted to want to.
Yeah.
That's something she needs to learn not to do.
If you're working in show business, you might be surrounded with needy people quite a bit.
This is true, but fortunately, I mean, they're all dishonest, so nobody ever pretends to be a real friend anyway.
I love that. Just talking about the working environment, what about the number of people who have autism getting work? It's a tiny percentage of people with autism who get in to full-time work. What do you think of that?
I've just always been a phenomenally lucky person. I mean, in the early 90s, I discovered that there was such a job as proofreading books, and you could do it at home. And you just sat there, you know, with page proofs, and you read a book, and you picked out what was wrong with it, and you got paid for it. And it was fantastic, apart from the times when the phone rang. You know, that was, I mean, I still think that was an absolutely brilliant job for an autistic person, because I was so good at finding things and at noticing, you know, inconsistencies. A book had been cited one way this page and a different way on a page 120 pages on. I was sort of like, no, these need to be the same. I mean, that was, you know, a very good job for me, especially because it's done at home. I suppose the only disadvantage is it is a very female-dominated job. And as such, you know, when you did interact with people, they were quite often people that sort of didn't quite get you. But they did sort of understand the concept that you were good at picking up errors, which was the point. Yeah. And then I just kind of fell into this. And, you know, it's fantastic. I would say it's the best job I've ever had.
You think there's enough work opportunities for autistic people, though, Anne?
I don't know. People always say, you know, I'm autistic, what should I do for a living? And I always feel like saying, I don't know how to advise you because I'm just ridiculously lucky. I don't really know how I got that lucky. And if, you know, if you're dyslexic or something, then you probably can't do what I did. And to be honest, I know I don't know what to suggest. I mean, there's a lovely novel by Elizabeth Moon called The Speed of Dark, which is about one of the things it's about is a company that makes a point of hiring autistic people to spot patterns in chemical analysis. And they have a special room with trampolines in that you can go and bounce up and down when you feel like. So that's obviously rather wonderful. But I don't know if there are companies like that. I know that Goldman Sachs always used to have a policy of being very autism friendly because they found that autistic people were very thorough. We are, in my experience, we are thorough. We are details oriented. The problem is we can't see the big picture because we're focused on the details. But if you want a details person, you know, we're good at that, by and large.
And we're coming up close to the end of our time. I just wanted to say we are drawing great things from the podcast. We're getting information from people like yourself and everything. And we're asking as well, as with your experience and us bringing up Daisy, we don't know what's going to happen, where she'll get her speech back or whatever. What kind of advice would you give then to people like us with Daisy? What would you say about parenting an autistic child?
She may have got a bit overwhelmed. When it comes to speech, as I say, if somebody talks to me, I don't always retain what they've said. I need to see it in writing, which obviously may not help Daisy. But there is this thing called central auditory processing disorder, where, you know, you can hear perfectly well, I have hearing issues, but you can't always make sense of what you're hearing. Bizarrely, I've found in the past that it's worse when I've just been to the dentist and I've just had a local anaesthetic. And I realise local anaesthetics are cut with adrenaline, and adrenaline makes it worse. So, you know, after a bit, it wears off and then you can understand what people are saying again. You can try things like perhaps teaching her sign language, things like that. I mean, that's not just for deaf kids.
No, we're doing a bit of Makaton, and she's picked up several.
I was going to say Makaton as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, she's picked up on several of those. Yeah. Usually around food.
Make sure she's got somewhere quiet that she can go, and you know, there's somewhere quiet without background noise. Sometimes parents say, you know, how do I make my kid listen to me? And I'm like, well, you could start by turning the TV off. He can't hear what you're saying if the TV's on. And I'm like, but we never turn the TV off. What are you talking about? Yes, somewhere quiet and unstressed, and where she feels you're giving her, you know, full attention without sort of actually enforcing eye contact. I'm having difficult eye contact right now because I know I should be looking in the webcam, which I'm trying to do, but you know, one's instinct is to kind of
look at
the face.
I can't do that either. If I'm honest, I can't stand looking at me, if I'm honest to you.
That's one thing I don't much like about Zoom, to be honest.
Yes, me too. And that's got nothing to do with anything else other than seeing a face like this. Though I used to be handsome, man. I used to be handsome in the old days.
Yeah, and last one from me. We've asked all of our guests this question, and they've all given us different answers. But if there was one thing, you had a magic wand, if there was one thing you could change about the world regarding autism, what would it be?
I generally wish that people were not so needy. I wish, you know, there was just less emotional neediness in the world and people could just be a little more self-sufficient. That's something I would like. I know other people would get very upset by that. But I would like people to be a little more stoical in general about, you know, everything. It won't happen, of course. But
what's the plan? You'll have a plan this week. Are you doing any recordings this week of The Chase, Anne?
No. We hope to be back I'm probably not supposed to give you dates, but in a few weeks. We are planning to be back and we're sort of making detailed plans about things. But I wrote myself a long to-do list this morning and it had things like, you know, put that bit of washing away. Now put that bit of washing away. Now take the bin liner out of that bin and tie it up and put it next to the garage door. Now do this. Now it's all sort of little steps here and there because I just was feeling quite overwhelmed for the last few days. I'm feeling confused about something. And so basically the rest of the week is just sort of plod through the little steps of things.
Well, Anne, you can cross this one off for us today. It's been really great to talk to you. You've been brilliant.
Ronnie, whereabouts are you from?
I'm from Ayrshire. Robert Burns, right. Robert Burns country. So in fact, I was born in a village called Mauchline, where Robert Burns did a lot of his courting. And if you catch my drift, so I might be related in some kind of way, you know, to Robert Burns. So we're all the hereditary.
My mother was born in Glasgow.
Whereabouts?
In Scotstoun.
My gran grew up in Scotstoun. Well, my gran, my dad lived in Scotstoun and Clydebank, the whole sort of area. Ah, brilliant.
Well, my grandfather was a publisher and he worked for Collins. So he was in Glasgow. And then they moved him down to the London office. So my mother moved to South London when she was about five. And so she grew up in London. I play for Scotland in international quizzing.
Brilliant. Excellent. I didn't spot that. I could have picked up on that one, Anne.
I have to say, it's just a great deal easier to get into the Scotland team than it is getting the England. We are quite good. We have some really, really good players. We do. We also have me. But the England team is just absolutely world-beating, and there's no way I'd get into the England A team. But the only I only qualify for three teams: England, Scotland, and South Africa. And they're basically there isn't a South African team, and I don't want to play for them anyway.
To be fair, Anne, I think the only team that we're kind of we can pick who we like is curling. I think that's the only one we've got. The rest of the sports we kind of come second. But Anne, thank you so much for your time. You've been lovely. It's great to talk to you, and good luck with the future.
Thank you very much indeed, and good luck with Daisy.
So I think listening to Anne, I found her really, really interesting to listen to. And I think one of the things that was really, again, it was something that Sienna mentioned about the sort of choosing of friends and not, but also the not feeling that people necessarily wanted Anne to be at parties and things. That was sort of quite a shock to her that people actually were interested in her. So I found that quite, I was quite curious to know more about that. But I think the one thing that stands out is about allowing Daisy to be who she wants to be. And she is unique, and actually we need to really, really sort of support that.
Yeah.
So I think Anne sort of mentioned there might be times if she wants to just go for a walk and be on her own or wants to do something on her own, actually that is okay. We don't have to feel that that's the wrong thing, if that makes sense. But so
what was striking is that because we've spoken to Max and Sienna, who are younger, and what struck me is that Anne really knows her mind.
Yes.
She's a formidable character, isn't she?
She's obviously, she has to work through stuff, and you can see that.
Yeah.
But she has a clear path.
The interesting thing as well is the nitty gritty, near the end of the interview, she talks about the list she'd made that day.
Yeah.
The things like put the washing in the washing machine. Number two, take the washing out of the machine. That's how she functions.
Yeah.
And for her, that's the way she gets on with it. And maybe that's the way Daisy needs with it. And that whole thing about routines.
Yeah.
You know,
it's hard to imagine, isn't it? How, because for us, all of those things just come, we just automatically do them. But to have to think through every single one of those things, and it makes me think sometimes about the whole thing with Daisy getting her dressed. So some days getting her dressed is an absolute doddle, and other days it is the hardest task. It's like she doesn't quite understand what we're wanting her to do. So I think it's just keeping in mind all of those things, definitely.
And to be fair, you make lists as well.
Well, I was going to say, one of the interesting things that I'm realising over time is that when you have a life with ASD, with Daisy, you start to notice in yourself the little traits that...
You just said as well, to take themselves away in their own.
Yeah.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, usually try to get away from the family. but sometimes I just need to go, no, I need to be away from things.
And I definitely think that a lot of us are on the spectrum.
Yeah.
So, and actually for me, the OCD, the list making, all of those things, I can completely get my head around that because that is me. So.
Yeah, really interesting. Let's get to the good bits this week, the highlights for Daisy. I'm going to go first. When I used to pick up Daisy from the playgroup, I used to pick her up. I mean, there was a couple of bumps, speed bumps on the way back. And I used to say, right, big bump coming up. And Daisy would say, oh, big bump, Grandpa, right? And then when she lost her speech, that went. I was on a road there, actually on coming back from the supermarket, mm-hmm. And we were singing. I don't know what I was singing. I said, "Oh right, big bit," because there's a bit of the road that really is subsiding, which I love. It's not a great idea, but and I said, "Oh, big bump coming up, big bump coming up," and we went into it. It did jolt us. And I looked around and I saw in the mirror, she was smiling.
Aww.
And I just hope in that moment she had that flashback to it.
Yeah.
Because she used to say,
yeah.
big bump cramper,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. Well, mine this week is Daisy, just over the past few days has become, she's always loved the outdoors, but she is just desperate to get out all of the time. And we got out and we've got this Peppa Pig bouncy ball and we've just been playing with the ball non-stop.
That's lovely.
And what's really funny about it is I'm typical dad. I throw it so it hits her on the head. And then you don't like that, do you?
She
but
doesn't she defend loves herself.
It. She loves it. But yeah, it's really nice just to sort of
feel I did that to you as well.
Yeah.
Well, that explains a lot.
She's a better header of the ball than I was.
Yeah, too true.
What, with that forehead?
No, nice one.
So mine is bouncing. So Daisy loves bouncy castles and trampolines, but she's never learned to bounce. And it's really interesting because I've just realised one of the questions they ask you with the health visitor development-wise is about jumping.
Yeah.
So Daisy's never learned to jump, which obviously is a trait that they look out for. But over the last week, she's developed this ability on her trampoline. She has straight legs. And by moving into her tiptoe position, she is able to bounce. But it's the funniest thing to watch because her legs are straight and her face just looks so pleased with herself, but her feet aren't actually lifting off the trampoline. But it's brilliant.
She
might be there.
Yeah.
She might be there before her fifth birthday with jumping. We'll see.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. Thank you very much for listening. We will catch you next time. You can get us in touch with us on Twitter.
At Daisy and Me Pod and on email, daisyandmepodcast@gmail.com.
Lovely stuff. We'll see you next time.